Matsuguno here, and I'll keep this short and sweet. It seems that our producer has a strange idea about what literature consists of, namely those appealing funny books often referred to as comics. And the producer seems to think these are literature. Well, if this gives me an excuse to read those Archie books while I'm sitting on the can, more power to him. It's almost as unusual as the pet rock. But then, what do I know? So I can't say I'm proud of this new development, but I'm certainly along for the ride. This is the first of three podcast installments in which our young roving correspondent talked with a number of comic book-related people at Alternative Press Expo, also known as APE. I'm not sure why. Do the cartoonists enjoy simians? Do they like monkeys? You tell me. Anyway, the interviews were sort of thoughtful and sometimes rather strange, but we'll go ahead and let them speak for themselves, if an interview is indeed a sentient entity. I don't really think that they are, but anyway, enough of me. Here is our young roving correspondent on the floor of APE.
Okay, so I am here with Doug Paskevich, am I right?
Correct.
Okay, the man behind Arsenic Lullaby, which is probably one of the most politically incorrect comics out there. Doug, so what do you got for us? You got a new trade paperback, it looks like.
That's right. We have, it's called The Donut Cometh. It's a collection of 13 issues worth of our most despicable stories. One of the main characters here is Baron Von Donut.
Yes.
He's a serial mascot, you know, complete with the top hat and spats. But he's on his off time, he's a stinking alcoholic.
I see here we've got The Work Will Set You Free here.
Right. In this particular episode, you know, the Kool-Aid Man would burst into the scene and go, yay, Donut, or yay, Kool-Aid. Well, Baron Von Donut has a similar shtick. But like I say, he's a drunk, so in this episode, he accidentally bursts through the wall of a Nazi concentration camp, and that story ends badly, and later on, he runs into the Chinese mob, and they decide to kidnap him so they can sneak cocaine into the country. What they do is they cover him with the cocaine so he looks like a powdered donut, sneak him in, and then scrape it off later, or snort off whatever is residual after the profits are taken. And yeah, that about sums up the whole vein of humor of the book. Very weird and disturbing. And
well, for people who don't know what Arsenic Lullaby is, maybe you could describe the zombie fetuses, the voodoo, and all that jazz.
Sure. One of our first characters is Voodoo Joe. Yep. He's a witch doctor, but he got cursed and sent to the suburbs to help people get revenge on each other. So being that he's a witch doctor, he needs a zombie army. The problem is now that he's in a ranch house, not a lot of square footage there. So he made do, and he just made zombie fetuses and keeps them all in an aquarium when they're off duty so they're not getting underfoot, and also lets them shovel snow, clean out the rain gutters and whatnot.
Well, one thing we should also note is that Voodoo Joe plays people against each other as well.
That's correct. He's basically bitter and out for himself. It's his job to help people get revenge. Beyond that, he doesn't really like anybody. He helps you because he has to, but if he can stick it to you in the end, just as well. Sort of like the angry clerk at the drugstore or whatever. Doesn't really want to help you, has to. Probably rude to you on the way out.
Now, how long does it take for you to draw and come up with an issue of Arsenic Lullaby?
If I'm not procrastinating, I can get one done in 3 weeks. If I am procrastinating, it can take up to 4 months.
All right, Doug. Well, thanks so much. And is there any sort of topic that is verboten for you, or?
No, not really. No, I stay away from politics just for the fact that kind of dates the book. You know, if you make a George Bush joke 10 years later, people know it's old. But if you don't, you can keep selling the same dreck years and years from now.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much, Doug.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
So I'm here with Daniel Davis of Caught Creatures, and you have a monster haiku book. Why haikus and why monsters?
Well, I love monsters, and haikus are a great way to kind of keep you from writing too much. So it kind of schools you, kind of keeps you from, I'd write 10 paragraphs about each monster if I wasn't careful.
Now, what comes first in this book, the haiku or the actual artwork?
The monsters, for sure, yeah. I just kind of get an idea and plot it out and make the character, and then I haiku later.
And are you sort of confining yourself to the haiku because you're sort of is this, what other stuff have you done? Are you a wordy cartoonist, or?
Well, no, it's just, was just for my first book. I needed some way to really limit what I was doing so I could actually like finish a project, because I could start projects all day long, every day, with a new idea, a new inspiration. And so this was a great way to pare it down to something that I could accomplish in a short amount of time.
And where are you from exactly?
Steam Crow Press is the name of our company, and we're from Phoenix, Arizona.
Okay. A lot of haiku people in Phoenix to pass away the heat? Or?
I have no idea. We actually know very few people in Phoenix.
Oh.
Just mostly the people in our cars. That's kind of how it works there.
So the hermits in Phoenix are the haiku people?
I think we're, exactly, yeah, we're the hermits in Phoenix.
Okay. All right, well, thanks a lot, Daniel. Okay, I am here with Shane White, the creator of North Country. So Shane, maybe you could tell me what North Country is all about.
North Country is it's about forgiveness and about going back and revealing a little bit about yourself and about your own family history. I had a rough childhood up in upstate New York. Well, it's when people say upstate New York, it's usually Buffalo or Albany, but we live like 5 to 6 hours north of that. So, you know, living up there, it's kind of God's country. So there's like a lot of, you know, not really backwoods environments, but it's just people in a middle income, middle class society that just sort of kind of is forgotten in a way. And I think a lot of the people up there, their morals and values are just different than everyone else's. So when you're growing up in that environment, it can be kind of a rough situation. So there's, you know, alcohol abuse and, you know, just general psychological abuse when you live in a mill town. So I figured I'd do this book as kind of like a sort of therapy session in a way. And it helped me get to understand my parents better. So by doing that and by naming it North Country, I figured it was kind of a universal thing that sort of exists, you know, because you have inner city conflict, you know, and it can be rough living there, but this is kind of an area that's just really not talked about much. And after seeing a lot of other auto bios out there, they were nice and well done, but they didn't have enough teeth, and I figured I wanted to do something that had a little more teeth, a little more violence, that I think maybe some people could relate to and find entertaining. So
basically, you couldn't, there. You wanted to sort of take on the niche of like sort of rural, sort of personal comics, and the fact that there's a lot of grit and a lot of bad stuff going on up there.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, when you, you know, it gets right down to it, you know, this stuff happens all around, and I try to illustrate in the book that it wasn't just my family. I mean, there's several families on my street that, you know, something always happened. You know, a kid up the street, you know, went to the end of his driveway and shot himself. I was at a birthday party, and my friend's uncle burst through the door with a shotgun and started shooting at his father out the window. It was just, like, crazy. But when you're 7, you don't know how to compute all that stuff. It's just, it's an environment that you don't get used to, and you sort of put out of your mind, and you think, well, this is kind of commonplace. But when you start telling your friends later on in life these stories, they're kind of like, you ate your pet rabbits for dinner? What? I don't understand. What? You know why? But it's just, you know, the way it was up there.
Now, when you say this stuff, I notice you've been referring to the sort of the content of this book rather obliquely. Maybe you can kind of offer a sort of description here.
Well, how do you mean exactly? Like,
what's the story exactly in this particular?
The story is there's two ways I can tell it. The main story is about me flying back home to confront my past. I haven't been home in, you know, several years, and I go back home. And as I'm going back home, I usually remember a lot of things. And I have a pretty photographic memory, and I remember being born, and I remember before that even. And as I'm going back home, and the plane is, you know, going through turbulence, I'm remembering more turbulent times in the relationship with my parents. And the closer I get to home, there's this sort of convergence of how I came to accept the circumstance in a way, but not forget it, you know. And also came to the conclusion of you have to forgive and to remember that your past is who you are, but it's not who you, what your future will be. So you really have a duty to yourself to make yourself who you are, if that makes sense. I mean,
I was flipping through the book and I noticed that you did a very sort of vivid kind of color sort of thing. I guess why was that particular choice? Did you make? I mean, why did you make that particular choice?
Well, I did a lot of the idea behind it was like to do photographs. If you look at someone's life through photographs in a chronological order, you can kind of see a story unfold. And I looked at a lot of the disparaging circumstances that happened to me, and they were all kind of like, this was bad, and I wanted to connect them all. And I thought, you know, here's a different era and a different memory, and I wanted to color each of them different, but yet make them seamless, so it didn't feel very abrupt when you go from one story to the next. So I took photographs from the 70s and I scanned those in and I used those color palettes. Like my grandmother's place, you know, it reminded me of the 50s. And so I got books on Kodachrome from the 50s and tried to use those palettes. And I just really wanted to immerse the reader into the era that I was feeling or how I remembered it. If it was a real fuzzy memory, well, a lot of the color was probably softer. You know, if it was really peaceful, it'd be, you know, a real peaceful palette. But then there were those hard-hitting, realistic moments when it becomes real vivid and shocking. So then I bumped up the saturation on some things.
Well, thanks very much, Shane.
Right, thank you.
So I am here with Miriam Labicki of Jobnik. So Miriam, can you tell me what Jobnik is all about?
It's about an American girl from Columbus, Ohio, who goes and joins the Israeli army.
Okay, and what was the sort of inspiration for all this exactly? Why explore this particular theme?
When I came from Columbus, Ohio, and I joined the Israeli army.
Okay, so this is autobiographical.
Yes, yeah, more or less.
Okay. What specifically can we find in Jobnik in terms of, like, what are the sort of adventures that the protagonist faces?
Well, I guess the first adventure she faces is getting placed where she is. I had wanted to be a medic, but I didn't really, when I came up for my draft board interview, I guess there was a bit of weirdness, and they sent me off to the shrink, first off. And so if you have any sort of asterisk by your mental health, then the Israeli army doesn't consider it worth their while to train you for a skilled job. So, so I ended up in the southern desert of Israel, like in where there was absolutely nothing, being a secretary in the infirmary of a tank training base.
So because of the psychiatric sort of examination, you ended up outside the actual affairs of the Israeli army, or?
Well, I was in the affairs, but I was just in a very, you know, very unimportant type position. I mean, there are lots of girls who end up being secretaries, and I was just one of them when, you know, I had come and volunteered with great, you know, patriotic fervor.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think I got the better deal out of it in the end because now I've got a, you know, year's worth of material.
Okay, so did you think that, so how did this experience kind of translate into actual this comic Jobnik?
Well, it was for a class actually one time that I adapted like an old diary entry of mine from the army into a 5-page comic story. And so I really enjoyed doing that. And I got a really good response from people that I showed it to that I just decided that I wanted to do the whole story of the character in the army. And so far it's, you know, held my interest. I've got 4 issues so far.
Well, thanks a lot, Miriam.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm here with Keith Knight, the man behind the Cake Chronicles. How you doing, Keith?
Very good, very nice. A little under the weather, but I'm doing okay.
Now, you've done this now for 10 years, correct?
I've been doing it, I've been doing it for as long as Ape has been around, so
yeah.
It's probably 11 or 12 years, maybe.
Okay. For some reason, I thought you had celebrated the 10th anniversary recently.
Yeah, you know, I lied about that. I've been doing it for about 13 or 14 years, but if you say 10th anniversary, they do stuff for you, so.
What are you doing now with the Cake Chronicles that you weren't doing when you first started out? What lessons have you learned? What issues are you taking on? Things like that.
Big
question, I know.
Yeah, no, but, you know, I mean, as I've gotten older, I guess I've just, you know, taken on more serious issues, you know, and also, you know, I've been married for 3.5 years. That's kind of matured me a little bit. And, you know, one of the things that I just dealt with was, my wife and I just dealt with was kind of a cancer scare. And so that was like one of the things that one of the issues that I've taken on recently that, you know, I've never done before. And but a lot of political stuff, and, you know, I just completed a book called The Beginner's Guide to Community-Based Art, which deals with, like, all types of artists that take their art and address community issues and stuff. It's a separate thing that, other than the K Chronicles, but, you know, it's part of the direction that I've been moving in. But also I've been working on a daily version of the K Chronicles.
Really? Where's that appearing?
It's not appearing anywhere. I'm just putting it together to pitch, probably, you know, for... I'm going to pitch a bunch of different syndicates this summer and see what happens.
Aaron Magruder, look out, huh?
Yeah, Aaron Magruder, look out, I guess. Yeah, I think there might be enough room for both of us on the comics page, but I'm not really sure about that now. You know, he actually did the forward to my latest K Chronicles collection. So,
okay.
Yeah, me and Aaron go way back to 2004.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm glad that it's been a very fantastic 2 years between you two. Yes. But I wanted to talk about this community art direction you were kind of mentioning. What is this exactly?
It's, you know, it's so many different artists from around the country do this work where they take their art and they use it to address different issues in the community. And it's never been kind of documented in the way that we've documented it. It's like part how-to guide, part graphic novel. That shows a bunch of different artists from around the country how they got into it. And it lists some of their techniques, some of the stuff that they've done. So anybody who's just starting out who might want to do the same thing can look at the book and say, oh, wow, you know, and there's a bunch of resources in the back. We got a great website with it. And it's called The Beginner's Guide to Community-Based Art. And what's so great about it is since it's been released in October, it's been... picked up by 10 different colleges and added to their curriculum, including Evergreen College in Olympia, Columbia and Chicago, and Harvard University. So, pretty cool.
Well, thanks very much, Keith. So I am here with a man named Steve Notley, who has a flower around his head, and he also, but that's not your chief distinction, you also draw Bob the Angry Flower. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, it's just simply the best comic, or, well, I can't say the best, but it is an extraordinarily awesome comic, touching on every aspect of the human experience, from quantum physics to bad punctuation to fascism to the nameless fear of death, love. It's pretty much all covered.
Why an angry flower?
Well, because way back in the prehistory, when I was trying to actually come up with an idea, I just thought, oh, a flower, that's easy to draw. At the time, there were no other flower cartoons out there, and, you know, it's like circle, petals, marketable character. And then making him angry makes him, you know, always gives him stuff to do. Even though he's not angry all the time, he touches on every emotion, but you know, angry seems like a good sort of lodestar, or north star. Lodestar? North star? I don't know, something like that.
Yeah. Touchstone of some sort.
That's the word I'm looking for.
Okay. Well, but why, what about peaceful flowers? I mean, and what about the charges by your critics that you have been called too florid?
Well, people just don't understand that peace is not funny. War is hilarious. And in fact, I divide that there's no such thing as good and evil. There's only good and funny. And so I subscribe to that and I hold to it. And as for being too florid, no comment. I simply will not respond to those unfounded allegations of excess floridity.
Well, here's the question. Do you have enough rage in you to actually keep putting out Bob the Angry Flower? Or is there an actual finite limit of rage or fury that you could tap into Bob the Angry Flower?
I think at some point I'll be dead, and then after that I won't be able to do any more comics. So, But up until that point, I think it will remain untapped. We'll see. I always wonder whether I'm going to start sucking, but and it's probably happened already. I just haven't noticed it, but that's why I did that Jump the Shark cartoon. So I could just sort of get it out of the way and say, bam, okay, I've jumped the shark.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Angry Flower.
Thank you.
Okay.
So I am here with Jose Cabrera of Crying Macho Man, which is a kind of contradiction in terms. Maybe you could describe this.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's a contradiction, an oxymoron, and it deals with, like, you know, the everyday macho man who thinks that, trying to come across being real tough, but underneath it's just a really scared man, you know? So, and my thing is all about contradiction, taking the absurd world that we live in and kind of extrapolating from that and just making, you know, fun and light of a lot of the social issues that are going on in America, especially with the immigration that's going on right now.
Oh, yeah.
So I got a lot of stuff. Like, one of my issues deals with the Home Depot. You know, when you go to Home Depot in the mornings, a lot of Mexicans are hanging out to get work, illegals. And one of the things that I see the exploitation of is the fact that these Mexicans are, you know, they're giving work, but at a very low wage. So I decided to come up with a comic strip called The Mexican Depot and put the Mexicans in boxes and call them a Mexican maid, Mexican all-purpose, Mexican gardener, just as a social commentary, but all due respect, because I'm Latino myself, so, you know, but that's kind of the things that I do, you know, try to point to injustices, you know.
Where's the Mexican Depot? Is that not finished yet, or?
It is. It's here. It's actually in my free samples, which I'm going to give to you, Edward.
Oh, gotcha.
So it's right here, and the actual comic strip is in one of the issue number 4 of Crying Macho Man. So
you, what personal experience do you dwell from for the crying?
Look at my brown. I mean, you can't see my brown skin out there, but it is definitely brown. No, just, you know. Slight, like, there's everything from subtle to blatant racism, and, you know, we saw in New Orleans, we saw the most blatant racism we've seen in a long time, and the subtle racism starts economically in the corporations, but like I said, like, I try to put a little light on things, you know, and try to make people a little more conscious of what's going on in the world. So that, if I get that across, I'm not here to make money, you know, because I already have my career, but if I could get that across, and make people a little more conscious, more socially aware, I'm all down.
Well, it's also masculinity is, of course, a big threat right now. I mean, to society, it's like, you know, politics is driven on masculinity right now.
Absolutely, and that's what, you know, Crying Macho Man is all about. Like, the idea, the moronic kind of, like, macho man kind of putting out, you know, his balls and trying to solve problems in a forceful way instead of trying to do things in a very peaceful, Gandhi-like way, you know? So.
Now, do women make an appearance in your books, or?
Yes, absolutely. Condi does a couple of appearances. I know, I'm kind of harsh on Condoleezza Rice, but, you know, what can you do?
Well, you know? It's deserved, I think.
It's deserved, absolutely. No, but the women do make an appearance, but, you know, yeah, the men think they have it all like that, but the women are the true rulers of this planet, so.
Very, very safe way out. Well, what's a typical story in Crying Macho Man?
Some of it can range from social issues, like the Mexican Depot, or the other ones could be really absurd. Like, the other day I got from Gillette, I got that Fusion, the 5 blade. And I'm like, what the hey? You know, like, 5 blades?
You know, the Onion predicted that, you know.
Seriously.
Yeah, the Onion actually did, like, you know, when they came out with the Mach 4, right, right. They did the whole sort of, like, fuck it, we'll actually do, like, 2 strips of aloe and 5 blades. And then Gillette comes out with...
Oh, and this is what I mean, this is the one I did. I did, I started with the Fillette. Fillette Senseless, 2 blades, and then you got Fillette Mach 3, with the word Mach spelled M-O-C-K, and then you got Fillette Confusion, and then the last one is Fillette Mignon. So, kind of things like that, and then, like, the other ones are kind of, you know, I love the old Saturday Night, the first cast of Saturday Night Live with Dan Aykroyd, when he used to do the Sledge-O-Matic or whatever, and I kind of do some parody on advertising, like Who You Roll With, and it's about, you know, guys who shave their heads, and the guy's trying to sell this product called Grogaine, and Grogaine is all about trying to grow your hair back so gangbangers don't shoot you. So, I mean, I'm bald myself, so.
Hey, join the club, you know.
So I try to, you know, I work out in the community out in East LA, and you know, I really have to wear a hat. I'm serious, because if you get a, you know, like, I'm Latino and my head is shaved down, you know, you never know.
Yeah.
You never know. My wife is a therapist, and she actually got her car got riddled with a bullet. Not too long ago, you know, so she's working as a therapist out in the community, so we got to be safe, you know, and like whenever I go out into the community, I make sure that, you know, I mean, for all intent purposes, you know. I'm down with my brother, my brown brother, but, you know, sometimes it could be a little bit dangerous out there, regardless, you know.
Does some of that danger creep into your comics?
Exactly, and it comes out, exactly. Who You Rode With is one of the comic strips that I've made about that, you know, so.
Well, Jose, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, man.
Okay, I am here with Debbie Huey, the lady or the person behind Bumper Boy. Hi, Debbie. How are you doing? Can you tell us a little about Bumper Boy?
Yes, Bumper Boy is this boy who wears a little white suit, and I guess the stories that I have are just like little short adventures about him. The first one being, the first book that he had was Bumper Boy Loses His Marbles, and it's about him losing his marbles, basically, and but the big problem is that the big marble tournament is coming up, so this is his little quest on trying to find his marbles.
So Bumper Boy is a very benign-looking person. How can Bumper Boy possibly lose his marbles?
Oh, well, it's actually due to there's a bad kid in this book named Frederick, and he's up to no good, so he's the one who causes Bumper Boy to lose his marbles.
How many issues of Bumper Boy do you have out?
Well, I originally had 3 mini comics, and then I recently, or actually last year, compiled them into 1 graphic novel. I won the Zarek Grant last year, and that enabled me to print this book, and I've got 1 more mini comic and actually 1 more graphic novel coming out this July, co-published with Ad House Books.
Now, how did Bumper Boy come to be? I mean, there's a sort of manga Teletubbies kind of influence here.
I'm not really influenced by Teletubbies, honestly. I'm not a fan, but I don't know. It's just I'm influenced by several things, like, you know, video games and comics and such. And basically, I always used to sketch characters into my sketchbook and never wrote stories for them until maybe about 5 years ago. And finally, I started writing stories for Bumper Boy, and he was born.
So Bumper Boy's been around now for, what, 2 years? Or so?
Well, in as far as, like, being public, it's been about 3 years now. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Debbie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm here with Matt Makarski, who has a comic here called Corporate Ninja. Maybe you could describe this, Matt.
Well, Corporate Ninja is basically a book. It's a comedy action book. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no,
okay. When corporations have trouble, like, with their marketing, or, you know, maybe they have an employee problem or something like that, and they need someone to turn to, Corporate Ninja shows up and helps them with their problems. The thing about Corporate Ninja, though, is he's just a ninja, so all he really knows how to do is ninja stuff, like kill and maim things, and it all ends up working out in the end.
Does the Human Resources Department employ Corporate Ninja?
No, right now he's actually a freelancer. He just kind of, like, shows up where he's needed, but eventually he might need some health insurance, so he might have to get a normal job. But that may be in later issues that'll happen. So
you got 2 issues right now. Where did this idea come about?
What was your name again?
You know, it was really weird. Just one day I was sketching, and I just was sketching out this ninja, and he was wearing black, and I just thought, what if he was wearing, like, a suit? You know, because, like, you know, suits are black. And I don't know, the idea, the name just kind of popped in my head, and it went from there.
I should note, though, he has these very elongated sort of curves of his body.
What was that?
The ninja character has these elongated curves, it looks like, of his body here. I'm looking here.
I mean, that's just my art style, you know. I try to do stuff a little bit graphic, but
A lot of my background is in traditional animation, much more like Saturday morning cartoon influence type stuff from my end, less traditional artist, you know. But yeah, I like to do stuff graphically, so.
What animation background do you have?
Well, I worked as a storyboard artist for Will Vinton Studios, but I also like Bruce Timm's stuff is a big influence on me. I have a degree in animation, so all the greats Warner Brothers, like Chuck Jones type stuff, like really big influence on my style. I tend to think of my book more like an animated cartoon than an illustrated comic book.
Perhaps Corporate Ninja, the animation, will come very soon, I guess.
Hey, if you know anybody, you know, I'll take any calls. So.
All right, Matt, thanks so much. Okay, I am here with Joshua Boulay of the comic Money Equals Love, which has apparently four completely disparate stories. How do these all relate? What's Money Equals Love all about?
Well, they don't really relate at all, but it's all about the love.
What about the money?
Well, the money equals the love.
So it's all about sort of loving money or money leading to love or what?
Well, actually, it's about the love for the comics, the art. The money equals love, just related. I don't believe that money equals love, but I felt like this the book is appropriately titled with Money Equals Love.
Where did the title come from exactly?
At work one day.
Did somebody say it, money equals love, that's why you're here, that's why you're on the clock?
Basically something like that. I was at work wondering what I was doing, thinking about my comic book, and then I realized money does equal love.
And have you made enough money with this comic book to equal love the love of doing it, or...?
Nah. But it's all about the love.
So anyway, you're endorsing this money equals love formula, and yet, you know, we're dealing with a little sort of disconnect here in terms of the comic. So please, you know, enlighten me.
All right. I really, it's just I guess maybe I'm putting on a front because money does equal love, but. At the same time, I personally don't believe that because of the hard work and love that I put into this book. So really, I prefer someone to see the artwork more than just the gimmick of me trying to sell it by saying, oh, money equals love, here, check this out.
Ah, so this is all basically a gimmick to sell more comics then.
Isn't everything?
Yeah, but is there an actual money motif in these four stories?
No, there's not. There's nothing to do with money in these four stories.
So there is, money has nothing to do with it except the fact that it's on the cover.
That's correct.
So you have managed to attract my attention and attract the podcast attention just by, see, you've succeeded.
Well, excellent.
Well, then what are the four stories in the book? Maybe you can talk about them.
Okay, well, there's four different stories. The first story is a space story. The second story is a boxing story, and the third story is a personal reflection story, and then I have the fourth story, which is a comedy. So it's kind of a mixture of everything.
And it all equals love.
Yeah, of course. It all.
Provided I give you the money.
Well, you are going to give me the money, right?
Yeah, I am going to give you the money. I've talked to you this long.
All right, well then, it works.
Okay, well thanks very much, Josh. So I am here with Evan Keeling, who has a very interesting sort of Death by Sexy book. Maybe you could talk about it. It's a series of flyers.
Death by Sexy is a series of flyers for a band where each page of the flyer, or each flyer is the next page of the comic. So I have to figure out how to say, be here at this time, at this date, for this amount of money on each page, while still making the story go along. And It's a pretty basic story about them flying through space on two gigantic cherries and meeting chicks and getting into trouble. And so I've just been going on. I'm about halfway through. I've done about 14 flyers for them so far, and then like a couple of T-shirt designs and a tour flyer that is a takeoff on Hostess commercials, the old Hostess comic ads.
This is like the world's longest scavenger hunt. You realize this?
Yes. Well, I was trying to set up, you know, it's like maybe people can, you know, look for, like, keep grabbing the flyers. And I have actually gotten through some of the people that are there who are like, oh, you're the flyer guy. And they'll have a few of them. And I've checked it out, but I've been trying to collect them myself, so.
Now you were mentioning to me while I was setting up that you were part of a DC Comics collective. Maybe you can talk about
it. Oh, yeah, I'm part of a the DC Conspiracy, which is a comics collective based in Washington, D.C. We meet about once a month in at Dr. Dremo's Tap House in Arlington and just basically get drunk and talk about comics and talk about the projects we're doing on. We have this book, the Dr. Dremo Jam Book, which is named after the bar that we meet at. And it's sort of a Doctor Strange-ish character, and it's a jam where it's like everybody does the next four pages, so we're constantly kind of going along. This is volume one, and we've just finished up volume two, which we're going to be premiering at Space. We've also got a horror anthology called The Sheer Terror, our anthology coming out, which should be premiering at Space, which we've done, and that's what all is going on. We're starting up a comics grant for kids 18 and under in the Washington area to try to, they give us a pitch, and then we pay for about 100 digest-sized mini-comics to be printed up for them. We're just sort of starting that, trying to get that done in the school year.
Now, aside from Death by Sexy, what other stuff have you done?
I am doing a webcomic called Ataxia Overdrive that is through Webcomics Nation, which is it's a tale of a trio of thieves, the head of which is this woman with these fabulous shoes that help her out, have sort of unknown powers, and their troubles with the robotic army. And so, and I'm just selling the first 12 strips in this little format with a sticker for a cover sticker.
Well, thanks so much.
Let's pretend we're in Antarctica. Let's have bizarre celebrations. Let's forget when, forget what, forget how. We'll have bizarre celebrations. We'll play Tristan and Isolde.
Okay, so I am here with Eric Adams, the man behind Lackluster World. Eric, how are you doing?
I am great.
Can you tell us about Lackluster World?
Lackluster World is a story of Fahrenheit Monahan. He's a newspaper journalist and albino. The story kind of starts off on his birthday, where his brother and sister, who are aggressive religious fundamentalists, try to convert him at his birthday party. That, combined with other things, kind of escalates to the point where he snaps and decides he's no longer going to tolerate the Lackluster World trying to change him. He's instead going to change it.
So it's one man against the world. It sounds like very much like Repent, Harlequin, said the TikTok man.
Well, a little bit. I mean, it's all about he's trying to stop the world from changing him, so instead of, before that happens, he's changing it instead.
What does he do to change it exactly?
He starts creating large-scale public vandalisms, and being a newspaper journalist, reports about them in the newspaper and tries to create a media spin to sway public opinion on certain matters.
Now, what have you done to sort of like, you know, I see that there's a lot of sort of a chiaroscuro kind of look to this book, so what have you done to sort of create this Lackluster World? Artistically,
I don't know, that's hard to, I mean, I just, sit down, draw it out, or well, you know, Lackluster World. It was kind of like, to me, it was like an obvious. Well, I'm going to use the black and white printing, you know, cost saving to my advantage, and kind of make an art, turn that into art. And so, you know, grayscale is important. It's Lackluster World, and at the same time, you know, the main character is an albino, and he's like the most colorful character in this grayscale world, and it's supposed to be kind of ironic that.
So lots of art direction. You basically sit around this this albino character and a bunch of gray and blacks.
That's right. Yeah, it's all about, and it, you know, the whole comic's themed about the mundane and how everything's so routine and day in, day out.
Well, thanks a lot, Eric.
Moça do corpo dourado do sol de Ipanema, o seu balançado é mais que poema, é a coisa mais linda que eu já vi passar. Ah, por que estou tão sozinho?
Okay, so I am here at the Hot Mexican Love Comics booth. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know who exactly to talk with first, so if anyone wants to explain what Hot Mexican Love Comics is, maybe...
My name is Albert Calleros, and my partner here is Ira Shirak, the editor-in-chief of this third issue of Hot Mexican Love Comics. 10 years in the making, right?
Correctamundo, amigo.
Yeah. And it's basically a compilation of comics from about 20 different creators. And the theme is at least something in the story has some Mexican relation. So it's thematically linked, but it's an anthology.
What's a typical sort of story in one of these anthologies?
Well, it is called Hot Mexican Love Comics. So the typical story is a blend of those ingredients. So there involves some passion, usually a little bit of love and lust and
I believe there's some crime in there because crimes of passion are involved, or they're legal south of the border. Is that correct?
Exactly. He's right about that. We've got a little bit of everything in there.
There's romance. There's action. There's intrigue.
Superhero stuff.
Superheroics.
Yeah. A little bit of something for everybody, and a lot of humor.
So if I were to read this, would my actual physical temperature actually burn up? Will I sweat profusely as I read this? What steps have you taken to ensure this?
Well, we've seen women come here, peruse it, and just drop to the floor.
Wow.
And it's pretty embarrassing, but
it's true.
There is a lot of heat in there.
We share the love. We supply love. Yeah. We receive love as a result.
We suggest that you do not read this unless you have a cool drink. To cool you down.
Hotter than a habanero pepper, huh?
Perhaps.
I mean, have you actually tested this in a laboratory environment between your comic and a habanero pepper?
Well,
we haven't done that, but we have had extensive hot Mexican love, being that Albert is of Mexican at heart.
I am of Mexican descent, so it's got that authentic feel to it as well. And you can use it as a taco shell. You just roll it up, put some meat in there, it's delicious.
Yeah, but isn't the ink going to get over it or anything?
Soy-based inks doesn't harm the environment or the people that eat it.
You've thought of this as sort of a secondary kind of use for this.
Well, it's actually made out of tortillas. So, nothing goes to waste at Hot Mexican Love Comic.
All right. Well, thanks, gentlemen.
My name, I'm about to tell you, actually.
Okay, I'm here with Mark Anastasia, who has an outfit here called Allergic to Zombies, and as a rule at APE, every single year I must check out and talk with every single zombie comic fan. So what makes your zombie comics different from the other ones? What's your hook?
They're not traditional zombie stories. In this book, The Coffin of County Cork, it's more of a cannibalism tale. Cannibalism due to necessity. It's set during the potato famine in Ireland. In this book, The Skull and Lucerne, the zombies are actually memories of my protagonists. Friends or loved ones or not so loved ones that passed away are sort of popping back up in his life and sort of haunting his, almost like daymares instead of nightmares.
So his friends come back as zombies?
He bumps into people that sort of spark memories, in particular memory friends of his from World War II. And he'll walk away, and after the flashback sequence, he'll experience these dead soldiers in the broad daylight as he's walking through a corridor or something like that.
What is your personal interest in zombies? What kind of got you doing zombies?
I've always been. I'm a huge horror movie fan. I'm a huge zombie fan, and I do have a couple traditional zombie stories coming out, but I wanted to put these out there first and. Sort of try to do something different. I mean, it's a genre that has seen a lot of action recently, so it's kind of refreshing to see something different. I mean, not saying that my stuff is all that refreshing, but I like the alternate ways that these stories can be told.
Well, what of the whole sort of, every time there is a Republican president in office, there is like a slate of zombie comics and zombie movies. What is your take on this?
Oh, geez. I don't know what causes the insurgence during Republican presidencies. I'm not sure. I guess it's the overall grim outlook that people have once Republicans take office. Just the sense of impending doom is all around us once a redneck gets into the White House.
But zombies are sort of a source of comfort, it seems.
Apparently, yes. Yeah, agreed.
Do you find zombies? There's a new one for you. Zombies a source of comfort?
I don't know if it's a source of comfort. I enjoy the discomfort that zombies sort of give off. I mean, these stories are so scary because of these. I don't know. I'd kind of like to experience it. Wouldn't you want to? I don't know. Be alive during some sort of zombie attack?
Well, twist my arm and yes, actually.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of know what to do now based on all the films and books that we've read, so.
Well, supposedly, but then again, it may not be a matter of shooting in the head. You know?
Right, yeah, it could be something completely different.
Not only that, but zombies lumber in movies, with the exception of the Dawn of the Dead remake. Now, who's to say that they might run in fast or as faster than us?
Exactly.
Maybe it's more of a terrifying kind of, you know, existential dilemma here.
Yep, agreed.
Well, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Okay, so I'm here with, I didn't catch your name.
Kevin Cross.
Kevin Cross, one of the guys behind Zombies and Broken Hearts, which I saw last year and I now see again this year. So what's going on with Zombies and the Broken Hearts and what can you tell us about it?
Can I cuss on this?
This is a podcast. You can say anything you fucking want.
It's pretty fucking sweet. Okay. We're lagging a little bit in issue two. We had a rough year. It's basically... I don't know how to describe it. Sorry, I'm drunk. It's about America's most charismatic zombie. His name's Edgar, and he likes to party a lot. He's bummed out about being dead because he wants to, get some chicks, some hot chicks, and party, do cool, hip, young stuff. But he's now a monster, so he's got to deal with that. That's basically the gist.
Well, that's the thing. I read this, actually. I came by last year, and I read this and enjoyed it, but it was a situation where, like, this zombie is, like, you're dealing with a love story of a zombie, so it's a little bit different from the norm.
Yeah, kind of. Kind of a love story. The future issues, he delve more into a love story, as well as him trying to start a band and be, you know, do cool young stuff, you know, just get hipper and try to fool people into thinking he's really cool.
So it's you and who else on this book?
Matt Delight. Yeah, he co-writes it with me.
Okay.
So, yeah. He's getting more beer, I think, at the moment.
You guys are starting early, I see.
Yeah, well, you know. It's the weekend.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I like to party. It's cool. So.
Are you concentrating all of your energies exclusively on zombies right now, or?
I'm not. I'm also working on another self-published thing called Monsters Are Go. Which is more of an all-ages thing, which also deals with some monsters and trying to start this rock and roll band and be really cool because I think I really just want to be in a rock and roll band and be really cool. So all of my themes are they kind of run concurrent, I guess. Is that a word? I'm drunk. Okay.
You're doing fine.
Am I doing okay? I feel kind of weird.
No, that's cool.
All right.
You didn't expect to be interviewed, did you?
No, I didn't. I totally didn't. I didn't expect to be buzzed this early either. I'm also working at a tattoo shop. I'm just starting to tattoo, so people.
What attracts you specifically to zombies?
You know, because they scared the shit out of me when I was a kid. Just because, like, this whole mob thing about a zombie, well, they'll kick your ass, you know? Like, because usually when there's a zombie, there's a million of them. But as I grew up, I got goofier and goofier, so the zombies in Zombies Broken Hearts are just going to be kind of comedic characters, which also, like, most of my favorite zombie movies, the zombies are kind of buffoons anyway, so they're fun, and, you know, but originally it's because they scared the shit out of me.
Why do you think so few people are willing to take on the sort of comic exuberant end of zombies? Because I find them funny myself.
You know, I don't know. I'm not really sure. I
we're only just now getting like Shaun of the Dead and like, you know, even like the Dawn of the Dead, it's there, but it's still a very intense movie. So, you know, there's no a pure zombie comedy.
Yeah, I don't know. Because, you know, in the last year, there's been kind of a glut of zombie comics. Which is also one of the, like, originally I was like, fuck it, I'm not doing issue two. There's too many zombie comics now. But then I was looking through them, and they were still kind of like, the humans are the protagonists, and zombies are chasing them, and I don't know. It's been done to death, and although that stuff's still fun for me, it's just been done to death. So, I don't know. I guess was my answer to your question.
Perfect. Well, at least we had a lead up to why we don't know.
Totally sound like an idiot.
Oh no, no, you're doing just fine.
We can edit out all the.
Oh, don't worry, man. Kevin, thanks so much. Okay, I'm just in pure random mode. So I just was walking around and ran into Tanya Roberts, right?
Hey, yeah.
No relation to the actress.
No. I get that a lot, though. Oh. Funny.
So what do you got here? What do you sell us on your stuff here?
All right. No, it's just sketches of drawings and comics that are up and coming, you know, and sketchbook and stuff like that, you know.
Well, could you go into more specifics, or?
Well, the comics are just really beginning, so there's two comics, and they're really just in the pipeline, and I've just done loads of sketches and artwork for them. So they're futuristic and superheroes and stuff like that.
Futuristic and superheroes, but what makes this your particular comics distinct? That's what we want to know here.
They're just great.
Everyone's comic is great. Come on, Tanya. You can go ahead and do some.
The characters are really great. We do a lot of work on the characters and their backgrounds and what they like and their weaknesses and everything. So you really feel for them.
Yeah, but what's the angle? What's the hook? What's the sort of, you know, can you divulge anything, or is it completely top secret here?
No, it's just it's not top secret. It's just that it's not really so developed right now.
Ah, so you can't talk about it because you're still developing it.
Yes, still developing, yeah. So.
But it's great, and it's futuristic, and it's superhero, and you care about the characters.
And it's super, and you know.
Okay, well then let's talk about your sketches here. So you've got futuristic sketches, futuristic being a theme. What draws you to the future?
Sorry?
I see that the futurism is a theme here, and what is it specifically that draws you to the future in your drawings?
I've got, this one is set in Japan, so it's Japanese stuff is like way out there anyway, but it's nice to kind of have some stuff and work on angles like that. So yeah, that's one of them, just all the drawings there.
Okay, well thank you, Tanya Roberts. Okay, so I am here, and I'm talking with the top shelf head honcho himself, Chris Storos. How you doing?
All right, man. Good to see you.
So you've got a really serious kind of crop of people here, including, you know, Alex Robinson as well. What have you got in the lineup, maybe coming from top shelf, and what is the top shelf presence plan here?
Well, this weekend here at the Alternative Press Expo in San Francisco, we did bring several cartoonists. We brought Alex Robinson with Tricked and Box Office Poison. Rene French is debuting his new book, The Ticking, which is absolutely beautiful. It was designed by Jordan Crane and meticulously illustrated by her. It's just a phenomenal work. And Liz Prince is here, and Aaron Rainier is here, and Jeremy Tinder, one of our new cartoonists, is here debuting his book, Cry Yourself to Sleep. So at 8, we've got, you know, 3 debuts and tried to make a big splash here this weekend. And then also for other new stuff, our really big book this summer is going to be Alan Moore's Lost Girls, which has been in development for 20 years and is finally seeing print. It's actually heading to the printer next Friday. We've just about wrapped it up, and it's going to be an absolutely beautiful book. Cloth volumes, hardcovers, dust jacket, slipcase, and it's actually going to be larger than the absolute editions of Watchmen and League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, so it's going to be in that class of product. It's going to be beautiful.
Now, did Alan Moore go directly to you, or did you have to fight to publish this book, or what's the situation?
Well, you know, when Alan Moore left DC Comics the first time in the 80s and started to do his own work with Mad Love, his own publishing company, he did 3 things: From Hell, Lost Girls, and Big Numbers. Those are the 3 projects he started. Now, From Hell was eventually completed and published, and then we're the publisher of From Hell now. And then Lost Girls and Big Numbers had kind of fallen into limbo. Big Numbers was a project he didn't want to pick up on. But about 5 years ago, I flew to England to meet Alan at his house in Northampton, and with the sole purpose of trying to convince Alan Moore to pick up Lost Girls and finish it. Well, lo and behold, nobody knew, but they had actually been tinkering with it the whole time. They had never let it go. They'd just been working at it slowly, slowly, slowly. And they showed me how much they had done of it and how absolutely beautiful it was. And so I said, would you allow Top Shelf to publish it. We would be honored to do a book this important. And they said yes. So ironically, the first time I ever got an Alan Moore autograph, which is something I always wanted as a fanboy, was on the contract to publish Lost Girls, one of his most important works ever. So Lost Girls is Alan Moore's attempt, not attempt, his success, to make pornography literary, human, thoughtful, and exquisite. And so it is something that's never been done before. And Melinda Gebbie, his now fiance, painted the book, and it's a 312-page volumes, all coming out at once. So 336 pages of fully painted, beautiful illustrations, and some of Alan's best writings in it. And it's quite extraordinary.
Did you have any sort of editorial input on this in terms of shaping it, or was it just pretty much hands-off to let Alan do his thing?
I am the editor on the book, but in that sense, it's really more of a shepherding thing, like getting the designers in, getting the book produced, helping pick the page stocks, working with Brett, my partner, as the art director of the thing to make sure it looks right, and, you know, hunting down typos and those kind of things. But I don't think I'd have the audacity to coach Alan on how to write the thing. I mean, he writes flawlessly to begin with, so he didn't need any editorial input on that regard.
It sounds like a pretty expensive volume to put out, though, of all the color artwork. It seems to me almost like a big risk for you.
It's a very expensive book to produce, the most expensive thing we've ever done by a factor of about 6 or 7, so it's huge. But, you know, if you're going to do a high-risk project, there's no better name to have attached to it than Alan Moore. And this Lost Girls is a pretty safe bet in that, even though it's going to be highly sexualized and there's going to be some people and some stores that may have to stay away from it, the book has had such a reputation and has been building for so long. People have been anticipating it for so long that I think when it hits, everybody's going to want it. Plus, when they see the package and how absolutely beautiful it is, it's going to be an impulse buy that's just going to, probably the first printing is going to sell out so quickly where we're not going to know what happened to us.
Now, in terms of stocking this in stores, is this a problem possibly for you that some people are just going to say no because they will consider this to be pornography or what?
It definitely could be a problem in some states, you know. There's potential that some people might have some problems with the interiors, but we've already had legal reads on it, you know, from the Compa Legal Defense Fund attorney, Burton Joseph, who's, you know, works for Playboy and so forth. And it is a legal book, but that doesn't mean that in this day and age when there's a lot of conservatism going on and people challenging things, that we couldn't not necessarily run into challenges. But we're working really hard to make sure that the book gets a lot of mainstream press before it even comes out, so that publications like Entertainment Weekly and Publishers Weekly and Time and USA Today and Playboy and others get a shot at talking about it, reviewing it, and discussing it in a free speech capacity, so that if we run into any problems with the book, it's already got a nation behind it, it's already got the industry behind it, it's already got a big name like Alan Moore behind it. It's not something that's going to be easily attacked, you know. So we're trying to take an offensive, defensive posture, if you know what I mean.
No, I got you. But as to the content itself, you say that it's sort of like, you know, it changes and it transcends sort of like the nature of pornography. Do you think, I mean, obviously it's kind of a strange question to ask of the publisher because you have a very sort of self-interested answer. But, I mean, maybe you can elaborate up on this. How does it actually sort of like, you know, push boundaries?
Well, it's the story of Wendy from Peter Pan, Alice from Alice in Wonderland, and Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz. Not so much named, but you kind of get an idea that it's based on them, right? And about them all meeting in a hotel at the outset of World War I and really getting to know each other in a sexual sense and in an exploratory sense, and reflecting back on their lives and their stories in a sense that their stories are really covers for the sexual revelations and the things that happened to them in their childhoods. So it involves a lot of reflections on those things. So it could be considered, you know, controversial on a couple fronts there. But it's truly a work of art. I mean, it's unbelievable. I've read the thing several times myself already, and I'm just amazed at how much of a commentary he does. Because it's a book about, you know, the Western world's hang-ups with sexuality and discussing sexuality. And it's also it also makes a statement that, you know, war is the ultimate pornography, not sex. And it really makes a strong statement on that sense. It also reflects upon itself as our own issues in our society with the legalities of pornography and obscenity, it kind of is a recursive thing in that it deals with magistrates and judges within the book itself. So it's sort of a reflection about the same points that people would have problems with. So it answers all its own questions within itself, if you know what I mean.
Well, I think it'll do just fine. I mean, you know, there's the Homeland Security guy who was recently busted.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, the difference is when something is drawn, it doesn't involve real people. And laws are designed to protect real people from being involved in these kinds of things. So in this particular case, it's just ink on paper. And in a country that respects the pen, then ideas should be protected at all costs. That's what the First Amendment's about. So this book is legal, it is safe, and if somebody wants to challenge it, we're ready to fight that full bore.
Rock on. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Chris.
Thank you.
This is the end of part 1 of 3 of our ape coverage. Tune in next time for part 2, where our young roving correspondent finishes up this order on the floor. And in part 3, he talks with Alex Robinson. Stay tuned. There's a lot of podcasts to come. Thank you for listening. Come on. What do you say?